You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, January 22nd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. Joining us today, Cliff Schechter from Cliff Schechterville. Also on the program, ostensibly to give me a film recommendation, no one. Had multiple people who my go-tos couldn't go to. Just couldn't. I was going to bring Matthew Film Guy on. He was on just 2 weeks ago. Kindler was on last week. Sarah Silverman couldn't do it. Judy Gold. Michael Ian Black. John Benjamin. Eugene Merman. I realize I don't have any more friends. That's it. Ran out of them. Also on today's program, hot con on con on con on con on con action. As the Republican Party seemingly shatters in anticipation of the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primaries. Meanwhile, in Clinton land, the Clinton machine fires on all cylinders. How many different metaphors can I make? Fires all cylinders to the forward positions of Bernie Sanders. Are they afraid? Are you afraid? Is it safe? Also on the program, ISIS cuts its salaries. Ted Cruz has a tithing problem. And apparently, the EPA had gotten wind of the problems in Flint, and the Michigan State apparatus just kept lying to him. The EPA regional chief in Chicago resigns as a result. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Now, we are exactly, I don't know exactly, 10 days? A week from Tuesday is the Iowa caucus, right? Do I have that right? February 1st is a week from Tuesday. And in past years at this time, I don't know that I have been this keyed in to following electoral politics. Now, I mean, part of this, there's really two reasons for it, two major reasons. One is we don't have an incumbent on the Democratic side as opposed to 2012. In 2008, I think I was just doing a Sunday show, or it was Marin and I were doing the show, but I don't think during the primary, frankly, I was doing a daily show. And the other reason is that this Republican primary is really important for those of us who perceive the Republican Party to be extremely problematic. And I think many of you would consider yourselves to be of that ilk. The what we're watching here is both fascinating and highly encouraging. And Cliff and I are going to talk about this more, obviously, but I just wanted to sort of put you on notice that there's going to be slightly more talk in the first half of the program, would be my suspicion, you know, leading up to these primaries during these primaries. I am going to go to New Hampshire for the New Hampshire primary. I will be up there on February 7th, which I believe is a Sunday. I will be recording and perhaps probably call in from New Hampshire, or maybe we'll do some other type of tie-in. And I'll do some interviews, maybe live, but also just maybe play some on Monday. Well, I'm not quite sure how we'll work that out. And I'll do the entire show from there on Tuesday, the day of the primary. And then get back into a car and get back here for Wednesday as we talk about the results, I believe. Hopefully that it'll all work out that way. But I will not be going to Iowa because, I mean, come on, it's too cold. There's no way I'm going to do that to myself. It's going to be freezing in New Hampshire, too. It's pretty cold here today, and we're anticipating a blizzard. But I just want to put everybody on notice. I mean, that doesn't mean that we're not going to continue to have great interviews that really are not so keyed into the elections, like, you know, the Eddie Gloud interview or, you know, ones like that. I mean, and even yesterday wasn't so much about the electoral politics, but about sort of the personalities. Coincidentally, right after we have that interview with, and I don't think there's any, and I do think it's coincidence, right after we did that interview yesterday about Chris Christie, the Times basically had a piece saying, like, you know, why is this guy running still? He doesn't really have a chance. He knows he doesn't have a chance. He is barely in New Jersey. And he's really spending so much time pursuing something that is quixotic, quixotic. And I reiterate why I believe Chris Christie is running so hard. And it is because he knows that as long as he's running for president, particularly if he's on the main stage of the debates, but even if he's on the kids' table, as long as he's running for president, he knows it's much more difficult for them to indict him. And I think, you know, a guy like Pete Peterson, they'll fund him as a walking advertisement for cutting Social Security. So, all right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Cliff Schechter. I just tell you, if you're watching on YouTube, we're having a sync issue. We're going to look into other forms of streaming. We talked about after the show yesterday. On YouTube, because we're having this problem with some consistency. And please hold off on IMs to tell us that. We may try and reset the thing right now, and then we'll see. But if not, please hold off on the IMs. We're working on it. And take a quick break. When we come back, Cliff Schechter.
Rosemary, heaven restores you in life. You're coming with me through the aging, the fearing, the strife. It's the smiling on the package, it's the faces in the sand. It's the thought that moves you upwards, embracing me with two hands. Right, we'll take you places, yeah, maybe to the beach. When your friends, they do come crying, tell them now your pleasure's set upon slow.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Those of you listening live, I apologize for the delay. Hopefully we are back streaming on the video stream. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Friday. And on Friday, what we do is we celebrate the end of the week by inviting this next person on who you can tell they're coming because you hear this.
Cliff Schachter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schachter, Libertas LLC.
Hello, Cliff Schachter. How are you?
I am doing swell. How are you, Sammy?
I am also doing swell. I'm just waiting here for the snowcopalypse or plocklocalypse or the, I don't know what we're calling it, but
the Great White Death.
Yes, exactly. No, but we can handle snow up here in New York. It's not that big of a deal, and it's on the weekend, of course, which means that
you guys are going to be whiter than a Trump rally. Oh, sorry, I couldn't help myself.
Well, let's talk. There's a couple of things before we get to the, as I pitched it, the hot con on con on con on con on con action that is going on in the right now. Let's first acknowledge that today is the 43rd anniversary of Roe v. Wade, and when you when you realize it's been 43 years, that it's been law of the land, that it is the right of a woman to have sovereignty over her own body, you begin to realize just sort of how deeply embedded some of these conflicts are in the within the American public. I mean, it's 43 years, and it's still remains an incredibly contentious issue.
Yeah, it should be a healthcare issue. It shouldn't be a contentious issue. Of course, you know, we've got people that believe that their religion should enter our politics, the exact opposite of what this country was founded upon. And so here we are. There also are people, as we've talked about so many times on your show, the right-wing gravy train who profit from trying to gin up as much controversy and, by telling as many lies as they can about this. So, yeah, I mean, and what I think the thing, the key takeaway that most people should understand, and I think a lot of people don't understand until you have older women tell their stories and the rest, is that since Roe versus Wade has passed, we've actually only gone backwards, starting with people caving and supporting the atrocious Hyde Amendment in 1976, which said that public funds couldn't pay for abortion, but somehow they can pay for illegal raids into Iraq and torturing people and all sorts of things. And from there, we've passed, I saw some list, and it was like 1,300, or I'm probably getting the wrong number, so I shouldn't even say it, but a massive number of restrictions. And
right.
In my state of Ohio alone, under crazy John Kasich, who tries to pretend he's moderate and only can get away with that in the Republican primaries by who he's standing next to, there have been 16 different abortion restrictions passed. And they've shut down a number of clinics, and we're on the last clinic now in Cincinnati. So women should understand that it didn't used to be like this. When Roe versus Wade was passed by an overwhelming Supreme Court vote, I think one abstained, and it was a 7-1 vote, because that's the way we used to do things in this country when we made huge changes. We didn't just do it 5-4, the way the current court thinks is totally cool to do. That finally made women equal in our, you know, equal members of our society, gave them equality, at least the ability to have some equality in our workforce. Obviously, we know about sexism and lack of equal pay that's still going on and the rest, but at least, you know, having control of your body means you can decide when you're going to have a family, when you're going to work, and, you know, you have some decisions you can make. And they've been chipping away at that ever since, first with the direct assaults, which failed. But now, of course, they're doing it in a completely sort of, you know, an end run around the Constitution by going state to state and passing things as stupid as how wide hallways have to be to try to shut down clinics. So people should know that it's a great day to celebrate, but in a way it's a sad thing because a lot of us have realized this right is there and have not sort of stood up and fought as the other side has incrementally chipped away. So.
Indeed.
Be wary, my friends.
Yeah.
Be ready.
And it really is ultimately, too, an assault at this point when you talk about the sort of the practical limitations that are being put on that right. It really is one that is felt most significantly, I think, or most most poignantly by low-income women. Right, because
absolutely.
It's that much harder. I mean, if you have only, if you basically managed to pass ordinances and state laws that inhibit clinics, invariably it makes it that much harder for people of women of low income to reach a clinic. And if you've got to show up one day and then return 24 hours later or something like that.
They do what they can, and because they know if it costs you more. I mean, quickly, I know we want to get into other things, but a classic example, my group here in Majority, Ohio, we had a woman who we helped come forward and tell her story, and she was one of the lucky ones, I'll put that lucky in quotes, in that her name's Sheva Guy, in that she found out at the 22nd week that she was going to have a stillborn baby that had a terrible disease, and this wasn't a pregnancy that could go forward and come out with her having a baby. And so she decided she wanted to have an abortion, and because of restrictions passed here, she was already at a period of time where even though the outcome was going to be what it was going to be, Ohio would not do it. Nobody in Ohio would do it. So she had to go to Chicago, which she said cost her about $3,000 overall. Now, how many, she was lucky she had the funding, but how many people could have done that? And so that's what it ends up becoming, like it was before Roe versus Wade, where a lot of wealthier women would go to Puerto Rico and places like that. And I'll say a shout out to a friend of mine quickly, who I think you probably know or have had on your show, Elise Hoag, who's the president of NARAL, who has done a lot to talk about abortion as an economic issue, just like paid family leave, and just like pay equity and these others that are key economic issues to women, such as also the right of women to control their own bodies. So,
well,
I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, and that's actually, talking about Elise and NARAL and is actually a decent segue point. Let's talk first about the Democratic race. And with all due respect to Martin O'Malley fans, we're going to focus our attention on Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders because of just recent polling. And by recent, I mean over the past 12 months. So,
poor Martin.
Yes.
Some bad things, obviously. I'm not a fan of all of his record, but I think he did some incredibly groundbreaking things in Maryland and was an early person to fight for seeing gun regulations, for marriage equality, and a number of the other
things. And he's been very, very good on the refugees from Central America. I mean, there's some things that he's been quite good on. But,
have you seen his biceps?
And he's also
got some guns.
Guy's got some guns.
Yeah,
it's interesting to me. I mean, I just want to make this point, because we're now 8 days or 10 days out from the Iowa caucuses. I don't know, Michael. You can help me out on this. It was maybe 6 months ago. There was a Politico reporter, and I don't remember who it was. In all honesty, I don't remember the guy's name. And it's not necessarily to talk about it. But he wanted to. Interview, he wanted to, for a piece he was doing, he wanted a quote or two from me. And when was that? Like, was it over the summer?
It was over the summer.
And he wanted a quote. He was doing a big piece on Martin O'Malley, which I don't think ever came out, actually.
No, I don't think so.
And he said to me, he put it this way, like, Martin O'Malley wants to know how he can, steal or maybe I'm paraphrasing, of course, steal some of Elizabeth Warren's thunder. I'm like, Elizabeth Warren, she's not running. He should be worried about Bernie Sanders. And the reporter was like, Bernie Sanders, you don't really think he has a chance of winning. And I'm like, I mean, are you asking me the general election? And I basically told him the same thing I tell people on this program. If Bernie Sanders can beat Hillary Clinton in the primary, he certainly can win in the general. And I said,
the primary is his tougher fight.
Absolutely.
I think, the two of them.
And I said, but I think I think he has a good chance. But I mean, at the very least, Martin O'Malley's problem is Bernie Sanders, is not Elizabeth Warren, and I don't think that they.
Or you could even say it's Hillary Clinton, because in a normal election year, I mean, normal, I don't know what that means, but in an open, more of an open field where you didn't have like one who had sort of been anointed, O'Malley would have been a very credible and compelling candidate.
Oh yes,
it's really
yes.
Just that there was nowhere. He doesn't have the sort of real far progressive record of Bernie Sanders. There's just nowhere for him to go. He's more of in the Hillary lane, if you want to put it that way.
Right,
and completely blocked.
That's true. But from his perspective, this reporter's perspective, and from O'Malley's, it was like, how can I be number two in this race? How can I at this juncture be considered the challenger? And he couldn't even get into that position. And so it just goes to show how much of a surprise. I don't think it is necessarily to you or I or to people who listen to the show on a regular basis, but in terms of both, you know, the establishment media and the establishment, how much of a surprise Bernie Sanders' rise has been. And I wanted to use that point about NARAL as a segue point, because one of the things that has happened this week is that the Clinton campaign, and certainly, and I want to preface it by saying, like, I don't think we're at even remotely close to the level of rancor we saw in 2008. I don't even remotely close.
I don't either. I'll say some of the online followers are getting there of both sides, who really I just tune out because I'm not engaging in any of that stuff. Either one of these people would make a terrific president, I think, compared to anybody in the Republican Party.
Right.
So that's happening. But to their credit, and I'm not saying that Hillary and Bernie at this point aren't hitting each other somewhat, but it's nothing like I feel like it was back
then.
Yeah,
and I don't even think the supporters are at that level. I mean, I just remember the level of anger and resent on both sides was pretty strong. But, okay, with that said, what has happened in the past 3 days has been, and again, it's not a function of rancor. I don't think it's inappropriate, but I do think it's interesting. The Clinton campaign, it seems to me, and it's not just the campaign, the Clinton orbit has been on like all hands on deck. I mean, from the surrogates like Claire McCaskill to the PAC, David Brock, to you see it in the context of groups like Emily's List and Planned Parenthood.
The ones that have come out and endorsed is what you're saying, like in the last week.
But also just in terms of trying to attack Bernie Sanders. And it's all fair, as it were. I mean, I don't know that the attacks are necessarily accurate but they're all fair as far as I can tell. And even on the standpoint of we're seeing an attack on the idea of a 21st century Glass-Steagall. We're seeing that coming from like places like Krugman and also, you know, the Washington Post. And it's fascinating to me because from my perspective, the real a test for Bernie Sanders is South Carolina. I mean, Iowa is a big issue, but New Hampshire, it seems to me, has been sort of a foregone conclusion for quite a while. And he's in Vermont.
There was a while, I think, after that first debate where New Hampshire started getting closer again, but Bernie has really kind of held the advantage there for a long time.
And if you are the Clinton campaign, you can always say, like, you know, it's the neighboring state to Vermont. It's an easy one to sort of say, like, that's sort of a mulligan. Yeah. Iowa, I can see, would cause a little bit more concern because that's very much about a ground gain in this and that. But
also, that's like seriously, like, you know, nightmares from 2008.
Right.
Where, you know, suddenly out of nowhere, not out of nowhere, but it was hard to kind of know exactly what was going to happen because it was sort of all three of them were tightly bunched at one point, Hillary, Obama, and Edwards. And suddenly both Obama and Edwards surged and just left Hillary kind of in the dust. And so it wasn't even, she came in third. She came in, maybe I'm getting this wrong, but as I remember off the top of my head, it was a pretty bad third, too. So.
Yes, and you know. No, but we should say, I mean, here's the thing, is that from my perspective, and I say this as a, I think people are pretty clear on that I support Bernie Sanders, at least in the context of the primary, even from my perspective, the implications of Bernie Sanders winning Iowa are not the same as the implications of Barack Obama winning Iowa. Because Barack Obama's big, one of the big sort of hills that he had to climb was the fact that he was black, or is black.
Yeah.
And Iowa is extremely white.
He was.
There was also a real strong sense in the black community that a black person could not be the president of the United States yet.
There was a sort of foreboding sense, I think, also in some of the African-American community that somebody black shouldn't be, not that they shouldn't be president, but a lot of apprehension as to whether someone should try.
Right. I think there was a lot of like fear in it. It was an amazing sort of, I think it's a very hard thing for people in the African-American community to accept was possible. And I think, Iowa in particular was the place where I think suddenly people said, like, you know what, it's safe for me to have aspirations for Barack Obama. And that's not the same dynamic as it is with Bernie Sanders. I mean, it's not like, I feel like South Carolina is more like that, right? Where the idea where people would say they'll accept a socialist, a self-avowed democratic socialist, or they'll accept, and by they, I mean the American people.
Did you see it? And I have to admit, I didn't even know this, but there's a strong, people forget that at one point Minneapolis, we're talking about 50 years ago, or so, had a socialist mayor, that there's a strong reform.
Kansas,
that started in New England. And if most of this country, Michael Lind has some fascinating stuff on this, if you ever want to read, just if you find this stuff interesting the way I do, that most of this country was settled east to west. I mean, yes, there was certainly the northern migration by African Americans, after World War One and World War Two. I mean, even before World War One, I'm not saying that there weren't exceptions to this, and obviously immigration later on changed some of those patterns, but initially, and a lot of that very reform-minded, civic, believing in civic virtues and good government kind of, a lot of that we see in New England moved across from east to west, and that's how you get states like Washington State having some of it, and a number of states in between, parts of Minnesota and Wisconsin. Iowa has some of that clearly, too, because 4 in 10 Iowa Democrats self-describe as socialist. Until I just saw that, I was completely unaware of that. That's interesting.
But what I find sort of fascinating to me is that, we're not going to know, obviously, until next week. And I think, when you're talking about a caucus, the polls are very difficult to read because, the quality of your support is even that much more relevant, right? It's not just the quantity. It's the sophistication of your supporters in terms of
the mechanism.
It's not even
just who shows up.
Right.
It's actually who stays, because sometimes these things go on for hours and hours and hours, and some people can throw in the towel. Right?
And it's energy of your supporters. It's the sophistication with the mechanism of your supporters. If you've had people who have been through the caucuses before, they're showing up knowing what to expect. Their ability, there's no surprises. There's no last minute whatever is going on. They know what they're going to do. And
right. Basically, what this is a reminder of is in what an absolutely insane way our country picks its presidents.
Yes,
how a republic that we are, the longest standing one that's had the influence in the world that we have, that you take a incredibly white rural state that's not representative of the country today. It certainly wasn't even 50 years, but it's much less now. And within that, you take a very then much smaller percentage of hardcore supporters who will actually show up. And then within that, you get smaller to a harder core of supporters willing to stay out the whole thing, no matter how freaking cold it is, whatever. And that's deciding who wins something that will give them a huge media bump and advantages in other states. It's really kind of crazy.
And they are marshaled
for president now.
And they are marshaled by people who have to have a fairly sophisticated understanding of the process, so that when the first round of voting goes, they know who to go to get more votes in round two. I mean, so this is all, but with all that said, I just became really sort of surprised at how hard the Clinton sort of klaxon was sounding. And last night I was on Hayes, and so I'm covering some of the territory that we did last night, but I want to play the last two ads, sort of the final ads. I mean, there's a real disparity in these ads, and I imagine you've seen them, but the first one is the Bernie Sanders final ad, and it's really, In terms of audio, there's just Simon and Garfunkel, a song.
But I would call, let me say, before you play it, that, you know, and I've come forward before and said I'm a lean Clinton supporter because of a couple issues most important to me, and I will say that I think that, this, objectively speaking, this Bernie Sanders ad is absolutely phenomenal.
Yes, and I will also say, just tell people what the visual is. Under this music is just images of people. It's primarily Iowa and New Hampshire. It's pretty white in terms of the people that we see. I mean, relatively speaking.
But I mean,
it's Iowa and New Hampshire.
You could stick all sorts of African Americans in there, but then it wouldn't really be accurate, would it?
Right. And it's, you know, pictures of, I don't know, a kid holding a baby calf and, you know, people cheering and working and farming and all that type of stuff. So let's play the Bernie Sanders ad.
Bernie Sanders, and I approve this message.
All right, that's it. I mean, as we play it, I realize, like, wow, you know, from an audio perspective, it's just this song, and you hear a lot of cheering and some dogs.
Even the audio.
Yeah.
I got to say, I mean, because I'm just hearing it, I'm not seeing it right now. I have seen it, so that obviously influences me. And the images play an incredibly important role. But at the same time, just that audio of Simon and Garfunkel, music evokes so much in terms of our emotions and our memories, you know what I mean? And obviously anybody who knows, you know, that song is a pretty famous song. You can hear the lyrics, you know what they're singing about, and you know what, you know, it brings you to a time of when people were talking about our being a better union, you know, of us solving some of these problems, of us moving forward and being together. And obviously the imagery shows a lot of that too, and the enthusiasm for him, which even, you know, is even, obviously images are so evocative of memory and that too. But I think that the audio is very powerful too. Together, it's a home run.
Right. Now, crystallize the message that ad is giving. I mean, you say, like, you know, moving forward and this and that. It really is about, I mean, we're looking for America. I mean, it's all about sort of like reaching our highest aspirations, right? And and it's a narrative, it's a story that he's telling, like, you know, we can be the America that we imagine. Now, that's a fairly general thing, right? Different people have it. But for Democrats in Iowa and New Hampshire, that is about, like, you know, where there's a certain amount of community and moving forward in health. Yep. And
if you're older than us, I mean, even our age, Sam, I mean, it's hard to believe people are older than us, right?
Right.
But if you're of the boomer generation and you're progressive, there's also a 60s feel just to having that song in there, too, of
definitely
what the ideals were that people wanted, you know, that people wanted peace and people wanted, you know, our money to be not be spent on napalming people, but on sort of reaching that more perfect union, bringing people together, helping lift up those who needed our help and gaining rights for people who didn't have rights. And that was the spirit of the 60s that's so often been demonized on the right.
Right.
Even just having somebody evoke that in a positive way is a pretty damn cool thing.
Yep. And so let's listen to Hillary's final ad.
The person who lives here has to solve problems as big as the world and as small as your kitchen table. That's the job every day. And now, the first lady who helped get health care for 8 million kids. The senator who helped a city rise again. The secretary of state who stood up for America and stared down hostile leaders around the world is the one candidate for president who has everything it takes to do every part of the job. She'll never let anyone privatize Social Security and Medicare or shut down Planned Parenthood. She'll take on the gun lobby, finally get equal pay for women, and stop the Republicans from ripping all our progress away. So on February 1st, stand up for Hillary, because if you want a president who knows how to keep America safe and build a stronger economy, Hillary's the choice.
I'm listening to you, I'm fighting for you, and with your support, I'm going to deliver.
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I approve this message.
All right, now tell me what the message is here.
It's much more muddled. Obviously, that's the story of the campaign. That's the conversation, depending upon how much time. We don't have any time, do we?
No, we got time. We can go late today.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, the biggest problem is for Hillary's campaign is exactly that, is that, you know, watching this as objectively, you know, from an objective perspective, it feels in some ways it's not as bad as 2008. They're doing things better. But just in the manner in which they sort of assumed they were the front runner and everything was taken care of, and didn't do some of the things necessary, it's kind of amazing to watch that process play itself out again. And on one of the biggest things, the complaints in 08 was, you don't have a clear message. Why do you want to do this job, and why should it be you? Now, I think...
Well, no. To me, this addresses why it should be her. Because this thing says...
experience and being a woman.
To me, are the two,
and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, because right. I think a lot of us would say, in an objective world, take Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and everybody out of it, we want to have a woman president.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean,
right.
Some point soon. If
I agree.
Not now,
totally.
Some point soon. So I think that, you know, is an important part why she's talking about pay equity and some of the things that she's done. It also, the part of her where she helped children get health care, that is something that appeals to families, that appeals to a lot of her core voters, right, who've had kids and moms, and but also the experience thing, because the thing
it's
obviously that Bernie is lacking is foreign policy experience in the same way. He's in the Senate. He has foreign policy experience, but not in the same manner. Nobody does it in the same manner as somebody who's been Secretary of State. So she's trying to play that up, obviously. And I think I agree with you, this does a better job of all of that. But still, the problem, again, is that I think that's an easier thing to tease out if she had been out there with a strong message of, you know, here's why what I stand for. And the reason I need to do this is because we need security in an age, you know, of terror or whatever the hell, and I have the right experience, and because I'm the person who, in the past, has delivered for kids and women, and we, you know, they're in more.
But even the way that you're articulating
whatever.
It, what's missing is what she presented when she first entered the race. When she, you remember that video that she presented?
I don't remember anymore.
Well, it was a video that was, I don't know, a minute or two long, and she only showed up at the end. It was all about the aspirations of different people
that
were out there. And that, you know, she's making the argument that I'm the most experienced and qualified to be president, but she's not making the argument as to what that experience is going to go towards. In other words, she's not saying this is the vision of America. She's talking about defending Social Security and Medicare, defending Planned Parenthood, equal pay for women, and stopping and defending us from the Republicans. You know,
again, that's a grab bag.
It's not even just that it's a grab bag.
It's not a clear message.
There's no positive agenda. There's no,
This
is, and even Bernie Sanders is, you know, we're projecting onto what that agenda is because of a Simon and Garfunkel song. But
not just because of that, because he has a very clear message at every event. It's about a rigged economic system. It's about the play by people like the Koch brothers who can spend billions to get what they want. And, you know, Simon and Garfunkel evokes is that, you know, there was an America that we once had aspirations for that wasn't supposed to be like that.
Right.
That was supposed to be a place where we were about community and we were about working together to solve problems. And we were about taking care of those less fortunate. We weren't greedy Koch brothers bastards. You know what I mean? And so I think, I guess what I'm saying to you, Sam, is it's the quality of the ad is better, and I think his is. But it's not just that. It's because he has a clear message
yes.
all through. And so when you pick the perfect song, you can listen to that song, have it evoke memories or have it evoke feelings, but also project what Bernie has told you he's
right.
going to do onto that
exactly.
song. Whereas with Hillary, you can't project onto the when she's giving you what she's done in terms of her experience, what she's going to do, because she's never told us what she wants to do with that.
That's
and,
right.
And that... Yeah,
and in
to
some
me,
ways,
that's the problem is there's no message of why her, because you need me. I have experience, and I, you know, in on economic issues, and I have experience in foreign policy. And with that experience, I'm going to, and that's what she's never answered.
That's right.
I mean, we know she's going to protect Social Security if you know that's what she said. We know she's going to fight against. I mean, we know a number of things she's going to do, but what's the outcome of all of that? That's a positive
well,
outcome.
Well, yeah, everything that's there. That. I mean, this is why to me it's more of a general election ad, because everything that's there is more defensive. Like, you need me because to stop the other people, and that's not what's going on in this primary yet. I don't think that's what it is. I mean, part of the problem.
Well,
is,
I don't think most of us think a President Sanders is going to be signing much Republican legislation if they control Congress.
Right, and I don't know that Hillary Clinton is either. I mean, that's the other problem I think that she has with her campaign. Now, again, I still think that if I had to, bet, I think her chances are better than Bernie Sanders, because, like I say, he's got he just has a huge deficit with a large swath of the Democratic Party. But my concern is that it's frankly like, you know, the big argument that one of the big arguments she has is that I can beat the Republicans and he can't because he's a socialist. And I'm, you know, when I look at this type of thing, I just think like this is a real tin ear here on some level.
Yeah, she's not. You're right. She's not hearing what's going on there right now. She can say I can beat the Republicans because I'm experienced at being the Republican.
Yeah.
There are ways she can make that argument, but making the argument is of, you know, he's a socialist and so he can't. Is I think again to most of us, when 4 in 10 people in Iowa who are Democrats are calling themselves socialists. What are you doing? You're writing that off. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't make sense to me. And that's, I think that has always been a problem for her. And I mean, the obviously, you know, Barack Obama had an enormous advantage over Bernie Sanders. He's African-American. And the fact is that he knew how to appeal to African-American constituencies in a way that that Bernie Sanders hasn't yet been able to do.
That's right.
And maybe he will. I'm not saying he won't. But what gave him a huge advantage is President Obama appealed to the very same upscale liberal whites that Obama appealed to the very same upscale liberal whites, but just by fact of being African American, being the first, and having experience running in Chicago and knowing having run with an African American electorate, he knew what to do and what policies to support to have that electorate behind him in
right.
an enormous way
right.
when they got to South Carolina. And that's one problem.
And that is an advantage
that
Clinton has have, because they have been down that road as well.
Bernie has to solve this if he's going to, because then Nevada, it's the same thing with Hispanic voters.
Right.
I mean, you know, he's got to solve it. And he will. He may. Look, this ad is brilliant, and maybe, you know, some of the things he's been doing, he certainly has been coming out and talking more about issues having to do with Black Lives Matter and having to
right.
do with, he's moved on guns certainly to a place where I'm happier with him, you know, and I think a lot of people are. These are issues I think that as he realizes how important, you know, I mean, people hear me talk about the gun issue here in general, but I don't know if everybody realizes that ranks consistently as one of the top issues in the African-American community, off the charts. Versus where it is in among white people. Go ahead.
Well, I want to pivot to the Republican race because you know the my concern is that you know if Hillary Clinton goes up against a Ted Cruz, or even a Jeb Bush or a Marco Rubio or any of those Republican candidates, the fact that she is experienced. The fact that she has a very clear issue set is going to be, I think, very helpful for her in that race. Let me just back up for one moment. One of the things that I think is a liability, at least in terms of the Democratic Party and in terms of like this notion of like she's more pragmatic, she's going to be able to get more things done. We're kidding ourselves if we think that that Hillary Clinton is going to be signing any Republican legislation either. I mean, I don't think that she's likely to.
I meant that with both of them.
Right,
exactly.
But that undercuts the value.
Fails because either of them
yes,
would block Republican
exactly.
legislation. So
it doesn't yeah. matter if she's better at reaching across the aisle for, you know, and you and I probably wouldn't like whatever the deal is being made. But those deals aren't going to happen. So it really just comes
Nobody's
down to
reaching across
who
the aisle
are you going
lunatics.
To appoint as a judge, whether it's a Supreme Court justice or a mm-hmm. federal judge? Who are you going to appoint? Who are you going to appoint to your cabinet and to lead certain agencies? And what are you going to do by executive action? And in all those cases, you know, from my perspective, I'm going to like the guys, particularly when it comes to the financial issues that Bernie Sanders appoints as opposed to Hillary, I think. But
yep, fair enough.
So that is a that does not help her in this context, it seems to me. But all right, let's move over to the Republican side, because I think that she without even I don't have to think twice about thinking that she defeats all of the Republican candidates except Trump, and let me just put that on the shelf for a second. And Bernie Sanders, I think, matches up against Trump maybe better than Hillary Clinton, because Trump, and I still sort of contend that I think Trump would be a disaster for them, but it's just such a he's such a wild card on some level that I think yep. in the event. Look, there's still a huge percentage of Republicans that cannot stand Trump. It's fascinating. Just in the past 2 days.
That National Review.
National geez. Review. But at the
who put it out there? You know, John Cole, of, was it Balloon Juice?
Yep.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yep.
Blogger?
Yep.
I think he put it on Twitter, I think he like, this may be the largest collection of douchebaggery ever in one magazine.
It's like, unbelievable.
It's every right wing. It's Bill Kristol.
Wait, let me read it off. I got it right here. The first guy on the list. Apparently what they did is they had the editors wrote, you know, anybody but Trump. And of course, Rich What's-His-Face Lowry had written just like 3 or 4 months ago, you know, Trump's pretty right about all this stuff. I mean, he's had to back up once he started to realize that Trump was going to win too. But they have a National Review symposium. And the first guy on the list, now, I understand it's alphabetical, but is Glenn Beck. And it's not like Glenn Beck has not been out there every day hammering Trump, but somehow by being in the National Review, which has a circulation, I think, at this point of, I don't know, 15,000 people, Glenn Beck's.
That's
so it's Glenn Beck. Then it goes to David Boaz from the Cato Institute.
They were listing this.
Brent Bozell.
As conservative thinkers.
Yes.
And I mean, Glenn Beck is a guy who Bill Maher, I think, once described, you know, as somebody who pretty much sits around and plays with his own poop, which I think is about accurate for who Glenn Beck is. I mean, a guy that starts crying on TV. And I mean, he's a televangelist is what he is. He's a complete fraud. And so him and Brent Bozell is another complete bozo. I mean,
Eric Erickson.
Like, there's another thinker, yeah.
Stephen Hayward, Mark
Katie,
Helping.
Another one, Katie Pavlik, who's on there, is a gun nut who I think on Jank's old show on Current, I went on and debated her, and she's another one who's a couple shelves short of a library stack. So
Dana Loesch,
they're not.
I fought progressivism for a long time. Before 2008, I crashed progressive protests using, quote, protest warrior signs. I mean, this is just insane.
Right. This used to be the key thing here, folks, for everybody to know. In a way, this is a very, like, really interesting moment that's emblematic of what conservatism has become. Because there was a point in time for whatever all the problems were with the National Review, and there were many. It was an openly segregationist magazine that argued that whites had the right to, quote, do what was necessary to protect their culture because whites were the superior race, and until blacks were ready that they could do that. They also were pro-McCarthy. So, you know, this is a magazine that clearly is not what it pretended to be forever, which was always on the side of intellectual thought. But to Buckley's credit, yes, he did push the birthers and the paranoid loons and you know, the Glenn Becks of their day, the Sarah Palins. Buckley did push them in a way out of the movement because he realized the danger that this group of people posed to conservatism, because if they infected it, what it would become. And yet, starting with the Southern Strategy with Nixon, but really sort of going on steroids from about the 1994 Republican takeover of Congress, it is these very people that have become the face of conservatism. So here's this magazine that once dedicated itself to being about conservative intellectualism, which was a thing back then. There actually were conservative ideas. Some of them have been put into place and have worked,
right,
even. You know, the earned income tax credit,
right,
was a conservative idea. It was a good one, as far as I'm concerned, for example. And, you know, but what ended up happening, inevitably, when you let in too many of your Glenn Becks and your Rush Limbaughs, and they start taking control of the actual sort of edifice of the party, which they have done entirely at this point, to the point where Cruz and Trump control 60 to 70% of the primary vote. So to see the National Review, which once was the magazine that stopped these types, now allowing these types in their magazine to stop a type of person that they created, that those types created, I mean, it's like, how do you get your head around the logic of this, or illogic? It's kind of amazing.
What's fascinating, too, is that you've got these guys who are against Trump. Levin is against Trump. And then you have, like, senators coming out and saying, we are virulently against Ted Cruz, and we are willing to accept Donald Trump. And I can understand, I think, you know, from the perspective of, you know, like, they're bringing out Bob Dole. And with all due respect to Bob Dole, they wheeled him out to lobby for a human rights
international treaty based upon the bill that he helped get George H.W. Bush to pass in this country for the disabled.
Yeah, a disabilities treaty, and they just spit in his face. And so they're actually going to listen to him about
And then he endorsed the guy who betrayed him, Pat Roberts, you know, when he was running and in trouble. Bob Dole was still there, and that's frankly the story of this party, which is the Pat Roberts of people who isn't even a crazy guy himself, but panders to crazy people to get reelected, doesn't vote for this treaty that was key to what Bob Dole believed in, but then anyhow, Bob Dole supports him.
We've got all these establishment types saying we're about to sign on to Donald Trump. They forgot that one of their establishment types, I guess it was a whole 3 months ago, was actually cutting ads saying that Donald Trump was like Hitler. Well,
but he's a Hitler that we could negotiate with. The thing, though, is just that, like, they're coming down on all sides of this, but they can't take credit. They won't take the credit for creating this monster, right?
No.
They won't admit. I mean, again, look who is on that National Review cover, right? Bill Kristol.
Yes.
Anybody remember who was one of the first people who, quote-unquote, discovered Sarah Palin?
Right. It was Bill Kristol.
Bill Kristol.
Yep.
Now who's Sarah Palin supporting? Donald Trump. I mean, you know, look, they create this monster, and then they act like, you know, they're whistling by it. Like, I didn't do anything wrong. It wasn't me. You got to stop this crazy guy, Trump. We don't know where he came from. He came from you. Because every time a Bob Dole says it's okay to come up with a crazy conspiracy theory about the UN and vote against a bill that would help the disabled, and then still is willing to support Pat Roberts, every time a Bill Kristol pulls out a Sarah Palin just to win, all right, and then creates this monster, guess what you guys have done? You've destroyed your party.
You know, I'm quite convinced. I mean, I have the data to show this, and I don't. It would be quite a reporting job, but I'm quite convinced. You can take all of these different players, and you can put them on, you know, one of Glenn Beck's blackboard or some type of magnetic
Soros Jew charts about taking control of the world.
And honestly, you would see essentially two or three different flows of money. And those two or three different flows of money, if you just look at those as different businesses, I mean, we've said this many times, different businesses within the same industry, that's what's going on here. It's Coke v. Pepsi.
You know what else it is?
And you're
it's
just seeing
fire.
Who is on what team. I mean, for God's sakes, Cliff, the Duck Dynasty family is split.
I know.
What has
they
become of
have
America?
They actually have a say in these things now.
You've got brother versus brother, father versus brother. This is like the
Civil War, man. It's I think if you look, I could be wrong. Obviously, some of this is different, but some of this is like the old-fashioned, like the fire industries, right? Finance, insurance, and real estate versus the extraction industry. It seems to me the extraction guys are much more Tea Party because they don't want anybody regulating. It's an anti-EPA, anti-BLM kind of thing. And then you've got the Wall Street, Silicon Valley types who want, who are more conservative. They want their taxes lower, but they want infrastructure investment. They want they want smart workers brought to this country. So they're in favor of immigration. You know, they want the money put into research centers and whatever to create the type, which as we know, Al Gore got laughed at for this, but putting money into that, into some of these things eventually led to the internet, right? So in some ways, this may just be a fight. We cleared away all the players between different types of industries and what's best for them in America.
Yeah, unbelievable. I mean, let
me say one thing I wanted to say before you kick me off.
Yeah.
My view has evolved a little bit. Not on gay marriage. I've been there for a while.
Oh, no. Cliff, this is not you coming out saying that you've decided to register as a Republican, is it? I mean, you're going to vote.
That will not happen. Right? Not only would that not happen to me, my kids know there's only one way I'm not paying for college.
Oh, nice.
Gay, transgender, I encourage them to be whoever they choose to be, except for a Republican. They choose to be that, they can be like, they can live up to what Republicans say, go out and earn their own damn money.
They're dead to me.
Right. They can earn their own college. But no, my view has come to be that I think Trump could go either way. I'm much more scared of Trump than I am of Cruz. I think Trump could be an absolute disaster.
Yes, I see what you're saying.
As a nominee, I think Trump could be an absolute disaster because he opens his mouth and says incredibly stupid things, like things about Muslims, whatever he thinks he'll pander to, whatever he thinks will work at the moment.
Yeah.
And the long-term effect of that could be very harmful because he doesn't have any filter, as we know, and could say something that could – but he also – he has a certain kind of charisma that even appeals to some Democrats. We're lying to ourselves if we say it doesn't. And he's more moderate on some issues like health care. And he said he wouldn't defund Planned Parenthood. And he can, he can reach people on certain issues and move back to some sort of a reasonable position on some things. And
to the extent that he's taken any positions on anything. I mean, what's he going to do? He's not going to have to reverse. He's not going to have to tack back from Make America Great Again.
No, that's true. That's true. Right.
I said during the primary I want to make America great, but really, the truth is I want to make America really great.
Yeah,
super
I want to make it
great.
Awesome.
Sort of an etch-a-sketch.
The thing about Ted Cruz is Ted Cruz is a uniquely loathsome character.
Yes.
Well beyond, I tweeted out yesterday a joke, and a lot of people retweeted it because I think they got what I meant, which was I need to stop watching Ted Cruz. He's making me like Donald Trump.
Right.
Just watching him, he is such a sanctimonious, arrogant, every word he says, I don't know how anyone believes anything this guy says. He is a right-wing con man. Worse than that, he seems to be, to me, I'm not sure sociopath is the word, maybe the word is sadist. I think this is a person who enjoys hurting people. I think he is a terrible person. He always has been. Nobody likes him. His freshman year roommate said he'd rather pick a random person out of a phone book, if we even have those anymore, than have Cruz be president. This is a story of Ted Cruz's life. Everyone hates the guy because he will betray anybody at the moment it benefits him. And he enjoys being so right-wing and nasty as to raffle away the gun that was used in Newtown. I mean, that was just an FU. There is nothing else to that but an FU. And he enjoys doing that in a way that Trump goes after people when he feels they've gone after him personally. But it's not sort of a global sort of thing where he wants to go after entire groups. So in that way, and guess what I'm saying is they are both terrible people. I shudder at the thought of either of them being president, whereas I am 95% sure a Ted Cruz nomination leads to utter disaster because he won't change any of his crazy right-wing policy positions and because he's so unlikable, whereas Trump could go either way. Trump could be as big a disaster, but he has enough personal charm when he wants to. I mean, people like Keith Olbermann have said behind the scenes, when he doesn't act like this, when there's no camera around, he's an incredibly charming guy. If he becomes that guy, I mean, Ted Cruz could not be charming if he tried.
Right. No, so I agree with you. And
see what I'm saying?
I think, I think the one effective thing that this pushback on Trump has done is it has created space for Republicans. I mean, look, if we're looking about a down ballot, right, what you want is you want the Republican nominee to show up in a town or a state and have the Democratic opponent of that state, that person running for senator there, or that person running for House, and say, like, do you really agree? Do you want to throw your lot in with Ted Cruz? And they're going to, that answer is going to alienate people one way or another. With Trump, it can be easier for people to step back and say, like, no, I'm distancing myself with Trump on this, because he's so... he's so nonspecific on so many things. Like, does anybody really know what his position on anything is? And would it be a big deal if he reversed himself 180 degrees? It wouldn't, because I don't think the base of his support cares about what his positions are beyond, like, PC and this and that. And I think they'll all accept, like, you know, I mean, if they're willing to accept him saying stuff like, Mexicans are rapists or something, hey, he didn't really mean it, they certainly will be willing to, accept him to say
that's
Mexicans are not rapists. Right.
He's a showman,
right,
like, so he says enough things. It's almost like when you hear a comedian say something.
Right.
He's sort of like, he gets away with more, whereas when Cruz does the kinds of things he does, you know, when he calls Planned Parenthood basically playing with baby parts, and he says things, and he tries to raffle off the gun that was used to murder children.
Right.
These are things he does you can't really walk back. And
right.
The thing about it is he doesn't want to walk it back, and he won't try. So... I honestly am positive that Ted Cruz would be. So, somebody has a piece in Salon. I haven't read it yet. Maybe it's what I'm saying. You know, the liberal case for wanting Ted Cruz to win. But I'm rooting for Ted Cruz. Because,
yeah, I'm with you on that one. But let's listen to – here's Donald Trump hitting Ted Cruz with an attack ad. And I think this illustrates what you're talking about. This is number six.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
Sounded like you wanted the bill to pass.
Of course I wanted the bill to pass, my amendment to pass. What my amendment did is take citizenship off the table, but it doesn't mean what it doesn't mean that I supported the other aspects of the bill.
I want immigration reform to pass, and that allows those who are here illegally to come in out of the shadows.
That amendment would have allowed undocumented immigrants to remain in the U.S. permanently and obtain legal status. So how do you square that circle?
Actually, Brett, it wouldn't have.
People want to take back their country. We want to do it in a humane way, but we have to have a country. We don't have a country right now. We have people pouring in. They're pouring in. And they're doing tremendous damage. If you look at the crime, if you look at the economy, we want to have borders. To have a country, you have to have borders. We don't have borders right now.
I mean, how do you argue with that? To have a country, you got to have borders. I mean, I guess that's what are you going to say?
We got to have borders, man.
We don't have borders right now. Well, I mean, we sort of do, but I guess... I mean, that's all hearsay on my part. I mean, the only time I've ever seen that border is like, you know, that one time I went up, I drove across, from Maine to Canada, I think. And that was just like, all I could see was probably about a mile. Like, who knows what's going on the rest of the place?
Down and saw that border in Arizona. Where'd I go? Was it Nogales? I think that's where I went when I wrote my book on McCain.
Mm.
And I'm telling you, you know, even then, it wasn't what these guys claim it was. There actually is something wall-like there, by the way. And you know what? Like, every stat will tell you that more people are actually leaving to go to Mexico.
Oh, yeah. No, we are at net negative immigration in this country.
So it's ridiculous. And again, I don't want anybody to take this as I, in the slightest way, like Donald Trump, because he's a terrible human being who... the thought of him as president is a bit sickening, frankly. But Ted Cruz... I think even goes a level beyond that.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. And I got to say, like, look, I watched the Palin Trump endorsement, you know, multiple times. The problem is, it's like it's so god awful.
You find yourself getting dumber every time you watch it.
Well, it's, you know, but the thing is, the problem is that, and this is the one part that scares me, and I think that you're feeling this concern too. Is like, I just have this sort of. you know, sort of slow building nightmare where it's like I wake up and we realize like on November, whatever it is, 5th of this year that like, holy God, I was laughing at this guy. And now he's the president. Like, this is how it happens.
This is how they always say it happened to Reagan. I was too young to really be paying any attention. But I tell you, man, people laughed at him. And he was an actor. And
well, but he was governor.
He was told to act a part.
He was governor. You know, I mean, at one point
he had more experience and everything. But even when he ran as governor, he was, you know, it got more so with the ranch in Santa Barbara and everything. But before Bush came up with his little brush clearing thing, which he stole from Reagan, Reagan became a John Wayne character.
Oh,
from
yeah.
The movie.
Oh, yeah.
He was playing. He's on his cowboy with his cowboy hat. I mean, on his horse with his cowboy hats on. And I'm just saying, Donald Trump, it's a different age. It's the reality age.
Right.
But he's an actor, too. He has one persona in public with cameras on. And again, Oberman said this. Other people that know him, Oberman lives in one of the Trump towers, right? So have said that he's different. And so my concern is he can change. Ted Cruz can't change. And that we laugh at Trump, but I do worry, particularly with the fact that, again, with some of the negatives that Hillary has, that Trump will seem so authentic next to her. And the thing is that Trump also has the advantage of he doesn't care. You know, they always say the most dangerous thing when you've got like a lion cornered or, you know, caged tiger, whatever metaphor you choose. Well, the thing about Trump is he has absolutely the whole point of that metaphor is there's nothing to lose at that point.
Yeah.
Trump has absolutely nothing to lose.
Nothing to
doesn't
lose.
Care about his reputation. He's wealthy. He has enough confidence in himself to think he'll come back again no matter what he does to him, even though he's destroying his brand. So Ted Cruz wants a future in politics. He's going to be careful. He's going to stay right wing. He's going to do what he needs to do to stay in the graces of those on the right. He also needs to make a living at some point.
Yep.
So he needs the right wing welfare. Trump doesn't need any of that stuff.
That's right. I mean, I think there's been times during this primary campaign where you can see Trump's sort of lack of restrictions and you know, it's win-win for him. I mean, I think he entered this race with the notion of like, this is going to be great for my brand. And, you know, maybe I could win for president. I mean, I happen to think at the beginning of this, he was like, who cares about being president? This is going to be a fun ride. And then I think at one point he's like, I want to be president because everywhere I go, people adore me. And I don't think he has a sense of like what being a president is.
Well, the guy with his ego, I think, was like, holy crap, I'm better than all these people do.
Yes.
Which he is.
Right.
They're all, I mean, most of the Republicans, I mean, obviously Jeb Bush comes to mind first and foremost, or Scott Walker, are so bad at this, that, you know, this is a guy that stepped in with no experience in this at all and was right away better than like 90% of them.
Yeah, and I think he probably, you know, came in thinking like, holy cow, you know, I'll give it a try, but, you know, these guys are professional politicians. I mean, this is what they do. And then all of a sudden he's like, this is a cakewalk for me. This is like I wake up in the middle of the night with like a crazy idea. I do it the next day and then it's all, but all right. Cliffy.
Rubio, I'll say last thing. Rubio may be better at using rhetoric, and Cruz may be even a slightly better debater, but as an all-around persona, you know, from in every different sort of circumstance, Trump has them all just defeated, destroyed, and that's what he's shown.
All right, Cliffy, always a pleasure, buddy. Thanks so much.
Always my pleasure, too. Thanks a lot, man.
Bye. All right, folks, going to go into the fun half of the program. We're going to talk about Jeb Bush has gotten his mommy to help him out, which is nice. It's nice to see that. It's always nice.
Dad, is mom there? Can I speak to her? George, he's not around, right? I'd prefer you not know about this.
Click. Hey, Jeb, what's the matter? Get mommy to change your pooper pants?
No, I am not. No. Mom, people love mom, and I think mom can
help
me.
Guess what? Mom doesn't like you. Click. No. Goodbye. Just hung up on you. Get off the phone. All right, we'll pick that up.
That's just
in the
Jeb sitting in the fun, silently staring into the void.
Yes. Oh, and also we're going to do this this great ad against Ted Cruz. Fantastic. I really am enjoying this so much that that it's making me worried that we're going to end up like that Donald Trump's going to be president. But at the end of the day, I'll sign off with this to those free beers. Just keep in mind that we're only seeing Donald Trump in the context of the Republican primaries. And in some ways, it's like looking at somebody who's like, oh, this guy's really good at kickball. I mean, this guy's really good at kickball. Keep in mind that the next round, in terms of this election, it's not kickball anymore. It's a fundamentally different game. So we are watching Donald Trump play on one type of field, and he is...
I'm fantastic at that other game, too. I'm great. Name the game, I'm good at it. The game that you don't know, possible. I'm great at it.
I think when normal people get to weigh in on whether or not they want this guy to be their president, I think he's got a big problem.
You know, I saw some guy with glasses on a YouTube channel, and he said it's a different game. And, you know, I'm great at that game, too. I'm great. Yes,
exactly. All right, folks. Don't forget, it's your support that makes this show possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off, free shipping. They'll send it right to your door. It's great coffee. It's fantastic. I've had other coffees. It's not, no other coffee is as good as this coffee. And also, if you...
because it's the best coffee.
If you buy crap online, you can buy it through our links at majorityreportkickback.com. Jet.com, which is a great service. It's terrific. I use it myself. It's fantastic. It's the best.
It's a great service.
It's the best.
It's a great service. And, you know, it really is a great service.
It is a great service. And I've tried the other services, and believe me, they're not good services.
But they're not doing a good job. But
they're not
Jet
doing
is
a
great.
Good job. There's Jet a reason why Jet.com is doing so well, and it's because they're great. And they're great. They've been very good to me. They've always been very good to me.
Jet.com said a very nice thing about me.
They said a very nice thing about me. And so if you head over to majorityreportkickback.com, you'll help yourself. It's really for you. And if you purchase things through Amazon, which is okay. I mean, they're not Jet.com. But Jet.com is really...
No, it's fine, but seriously...
They've come out of nowhere.
We wish them the best. It's fine.
No,
it's okay.
I wish all of them the best.
Yeah.
I love everybody. I love every way to buy things.
But Amazon should be ashamed of itself. Just be who
majority,
you are.
MajorityReportKickback.com. All right, folks. 646-257-3920.
Jeff Bezos doesn't want people to know that he tortures workers, but he should embrace that he does. That's who he is.
646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920. We'll take your IMs. See you in the fun house.